So we're going to conclude today with a talk which will be followed by an opportunity for discussion, questions and answers and so on. Can you hear me clearly at the back?
Yeah.
This morning I spoke about the awakening of the Buddha in terms of it being a kind of existential shift from a perspective that is locked into concern with one's position, one's place, one's status, one's psychological identity perhaps, around which one's thoughts and feelings and emotions seem constantly to be sort of turning and grinding. And how he saw his waking up as a radical opening to what he calls this ground. But a ground that's not solid and firm and fixed, but rather a ground which is constantly in motion, which is constantly unravelling and unfolding, arising, vanishing and passing away. And the technical term he uses is paticca-samuppada, which gets translated as dependent origination, conditioned arising. But if we put aside the Buddhist jargon, I think the word in English that captures this best is simply the word life. I mean, that is what life does. Life is constantly on the move. Life is constantly creating and dying, being born again, renewing itself, shifting, blowing in the wind. And as a means whereby to pay attention to this ground, he suggests this practice of sati, of mindfulness, of a systematic slowing down, quietening of our obsessive habitual thinking, and opening our senses to what we see, hear, smell, taste, touch, feel, to this transient and sometimes tragic and contingent and unfolding array, this highly complex array of sensations and feelings and perceptions and impulses and so forth and so on. And it is somewhat characteristic of the way in which the Buddha teaches that rather than try to resolve diversity and plurality and complexity into some kind of higher unity, he does exactly the opposite. He constantly, in his teaching, emphasizes difference and plurality and specificity. So instead of speaking of the human being as body and mind, for example, he speaks of it as being composed of five aggregates. And when you first encounter Buddhism, you often wonder, well, why five? But the point, I think, is more in order that there not be just one or two. In other words, the more comfortable and apparently more manageable idea that I am either one thing or two things, a body and a mind, or simply perhaps just a body or just a mind. But no, the Buddha from the very outset starts with five. Our physical existence, our emotional life, our perceptions, our impulses, our intentions, our consciousness. And when he goes into each of these particular elements, instead of defining it as this or that, he breaks it down even further still. And so this gives us a clue, I think, to the sort of awareness that is being cultivated here. And that is one that is open to an increasing encounter with diversity, plurality, complexity, as something also that's not fixed or static in any way, but continuously in process. And so the very idea of awakening or enlightenment as being a sort of mystical state in which one has privileged access to some great unifying truth has to give way, really, to awakening, and I really don't like using the word enlightenment, so I won't, awakening as really a process. It's ongoing. And this seems almost inevitable, given what it is that the Buddha is awakening to. He's not awakening to some single transcendent truth, but he's awakening to the unraveling complexity of life itself. And he's finding through the disciplines of attention and concentration, all of the things that we talk of when we describe meditation. He's talking of this very much as a stratagem, as a means, as a way of being, in which we can be with this complexity, an often very bewildering diversity, from a point of stillness, a point of openness that has a greater capacity, perhaps, to respond to this without simply slipping back into those most familiar grooves and habits of our status-oriented perspective. And it's worth pointing out, too, that when he describes the practice of mindfulness, he calls it satipatthana, which means, literally, the grounding of mindfulness. And the word patthana is the same word, tana, as he uses when he talks of his awakening as an awakening to a ground, dependent origination, conditionality, tana, and it's satipatthana. There's a very close connection here between the exercise of mindfulness, the grounding of that, in the ground of life itself. It's very much about grounding. But nonetheless, in this passage we've been looking at up to now, the Buddha has only presented, as it were, a principle, that of conditioned arising, life, perhaps we might call it. It still is at a relatively abstract level, and it doesn't in itself provide us with a frame of action. It doesn't, as it were, in itself tell us what to do. It says in the text that after he's had this experience, he spends a number of weeks in a kind of bafflement and hesitation. He wonders whether anyone will actually grasp what it is he's trying to say. And after a while, it dawns on him that, well, yes, there must be some people out there who'll get this. And so he then decides to go and track down some fellow companions of his and to try and explain this to them. So he heads off for the city of Benares, which was then and still is the great capital of Hinduism, Brahmanism. And there he finds his friends. And it's in teaching them that he begins to articulate a practice or a way of life rather than simply describing what he's experienced in terms of conditioned arising or conditionality. He translates, in other words, this principle or this axiom into a form of life. If we were to consider this idea of dependent origination as the kind of E equals MC squared of the Buddha's teaching, then we can see the next steps in his public discourse as an attempt to translate the axiom into a practice. So let's look now at how he does that. He does that through the model, which I'm sure most of us are familiar, of the Four Noble Truths. The first discourse, which is very short, it's about 2 pages in translation, is primarily concerned with introducing the idea of a middle path, and then as a means to arrive at such a middle path, he presents 4 noble truths. Now these 4 truths, the first is that of suffering, the second is that of craving, which is seen as the origin of suffering, the third is that of the cessation of suffering or craving specifically, and the fourth is the path or the middle way itself. But what is perhaps more important is not to think of these 4 truths as 4 sort of truth claims or propositions in which if we were to believe in would somehow qualify us to be Buddhists, but rather we need to see how each of these truths is not just a fact about the world or about the person, but these truths are essentially injunctions to do something. This is the crucial point. So when he speaks of dukkha, of suffering, he's qualifying that in saying suffering is something to be fully known. When he speaks of craving, he speaks of it in terms of craving being something that needs to be let go of. When he speaks of the cessation of craving, nirvana, he speaks of that as something to be experienced directly. And when he talks about the path, the Eightfold Path, he speaks of something which is to be created, which is to be cultivated. We can summarize this in 4 simple sentences. They're kind of injunctions, really. Embrace suffering, let go of grasping, experience stopping, and create a path. Now that presents us with a sequence of actions. And the reason the Buddha presented these 4 truths in the order he did is, I believe, because when you think of them in terms of actions rather than propositions, one will organically lead to the next. So in keeping with his principle of conditioned arising, in other words, when this condition is present, that event will come to be, the 4 truths are, as it were, a teasing out of that principle into a sequence of acts. So the one who fully knows dukkha or suffering will give rise to the possibility that grasping will stop. And the grasping will then be let go of. I'll come back to all this. That when one starts to let go of that grasping, one creates the condition for that grasping coming to an end. And when one experiences the stopping of that clinging or clutching or grasping, that opens up the possibility for the creation of a path. Now, what this points to is that the Buddha is primarily concerned not with nibbana, nirvana, or liberation from birth and death, as it's classically understood, or even nibbana as a kind of internal state of transcendent freedom or liberation. But rather he sees nibbana, these moments of stopping, as the portal to the beginning of a path. I believe that the Buddha's primary concern in his teaching was to bring into being this Eightfold Path. And remember, the path that he speaks of is not an exclusively spiritual path. It embraces every aspect of our lives. It starts with how we see things. It moves on to how we think about them, how we communicate, how we physically act, how we earn our living, how we focus our lives through commitment and engagement and resolve. And only then does he start to talk about practicing mindfulness and concentration. So the four truths are really a kind of template within which we can understand more precisely and in a far more concrete way this process of opening to this ground of conditionality, this ground of life itself. We now have, as it were, a kind of practice that we can put into play, starting with what he calls dukkha parinya, fully knowing dukkha. Now, dukkha is one of those words that's very difficult, really, to translate adequately into English. It's usually translated as suffering, and that's not exactly wrong, but it doesn't cover the entire range of what the Buddha intended by that word. If we think of it as suffering, then we think of it immediately as a subjective experience of pain of some kind or other. But the Buddha also uses the word dukkha to describe the condition of the world itself. He says that all conditions are dukkha. All conditions are impermanent. All conditions are dukkha. Conditions, or sankhara, means anything that has been created or come into being that is impermanent, that is a condition. This glass of water is a sankhara. It's a condition. But what does it mean to say that this glass of water is dukkha? Painful. In pain. I don't think the glass of water suffers if I drop it on the floor. So clearly we have to rethink what the Buddha here means by dukkha, by suffering. My own sense is that dukkha in this context means something like unreliable, undependable, and not something we can really count on in the end. That all conditions, all the events of life, because in a way they are transient, that they are ephemeral, that they cannot ever provide an adequate ground or basis for fulfilling our deepest longings for well-being. No matter how much we manage to manipulate the conditions of our lives, our physical existence, our social existence, all of those things we spoke of this morning, no matter how much we acquire, no matter how famous we become, in the end, these things will let us down. Because either they will be lost or destroyed or betrayed, or we will simply stop living here and die. We can only achieve a very temporary kind of well-being by relying on impermanent and transient conditions. So when the Buddha says, fully know dukkha, he's actually asking us to look into the tragic structure of our life itself. And when he describes this, the noble truth of suffering, he starts by saying, birth is dukkha. Sickness, aging, death are dukkha. Not getting what you want is dukkha. Getting what you don't want is dukkha. We all know what this means. He's clearly not talking just about specific instances of physical or mental pain. He's talking about opening our eyes to the fact that there is something tragic built into the very structure of the world itself. Something that will not last or endure in such a way that we can depend upon it for our essential well-being. Now, of course, intellectually, we probably would more or less accept some theory of that nature. But the problem is, habitually and instinctively, we behave as though that were certainly not the case. Instinctively, we are convinced that if only we could sort out our life in such a way that we got rid of X and we acquired Y, we just tinkered with it a little bit more, if we just got it right, we would achieve some kind of utopian perfection in this world. And the Buddha is suggesting that that is a complete waste of time, that it's not a realizable goal. Now, it's quite commonly objected at this point that surely this is a very pessimistic way of looking at life. That if we all believed this, no one would do anything, and everything would be terribly morbid and gloomy, and we'd just sit around waiting for old age and death to wipe us out. But this, I think, is clearly not the case. For a start, we have to see this idea of dukkha in the context of this process of these four truths. The knowing of dukkha is the beginning of a letting go of a certain clinging or grasping, which in turn leads us to another relationship to the world in which we live, from whence we can start a way of life that's not premised on the idea of acquisition and rejection and holding and clinging and so on. And that's what this practice is so very much about. But the other side of it is that by shying away from tragedy, from the dark side of life, we also deny life itself. It actually becomes one of those attitudes that somehow anesthetizes us to the actuality of the unfolding of life as such. And let me give you an example. When I was a monk in the Tibetan tradition, one of the meditations that we were instructed to do on a daily basis was a meditation on death. And we would sit down for half an hour or so a day, and we would systematically think through the fact that death is the only thing that is certain. Death is the only thing that is certain. Everything else that we plan for or hope for or long for or fear may not happen. Only one thing is held for us with no doubt at all in the future, and that is our death. Now again, we know that, but do we really know it? Has that recognition really been integrated into our lives at a kind of intuitive, almost somatic level? That's the question. By doing these kinds of meditations, what one finds is not that one's awareness of death makes one that much more depressed and aware of the futility of life, but exactly the opposite. that when you notice that death is the only thing that is certain, and also that this certain thing could occur at any moment, that its time is utterly uncertain, when you start to really let that register, what you become aware of in a very vital way is the fact that you're alive, the fact that you're not dead. And I found that through doing this kind of meditation, it actually was almost exhilarating. It brought me into a very, very vivid sense of the preciousness of life itself, the extraordinariness of life itself, the fact that all of this that we take so much for granted is really just a momentary gift that could be cut off at any moment. I mean, we've all had friends or acquaintances who have been alive one day and the next day have been killed in an accident or they've had a heart attack. And we tend to think that that only happens to other people, which in a very naive sense is true. But we don't register the fact that it could happen to us. Now this, I think, is an example of what the Buddha calls fully knowing dukkha. The word perhaps that is most important there is the word fully. We know these things, but we don't fully know them. It's the same with the breath. We know that we're breathing out and breathing in, but we don't fully know what that means or what that is actually even like. We know that we walk up and down. We know that we sit on the cushion. But do we fully know that? Do we know that in our bones? Do we know that deep down in our body? Or is it just a piece of information that we can repeat to somebody else if we have to? And this, I feel, is so much what lies at the heart of this practice of mindful meditation, is that we're slowing down, stopping, and paying attention from a deeper place than we normally do. And we're doing something that might at times feel a bit boring. It might take a while to somehow get it, to somehow become open and attuned to that way of being. But once we do, we begin to realize that so much of our awareness and our consciousness is kind of just skimming along the surface of life. It's not really registering at a deeper level. Now, of course, we all have moments in our lives, and I hope we have many of them, in which we do appreciate things in a more open, in a more profound way than perhaps our everyday chattering mind allows or suggests. But what this exercise that we're doing today is about is systematically working on that process, not just waiting for moments of great joy and great intimacy and great love of nature and so on, but actually opening ourselves and preparing ourselves in such a way that our lives become more and more infused with this sensibility, this capacity to be far more in tune and present with what is rising and vanishing in each moment. It's trying to ground within ourselves another perspective, another way of being, one that we know at some level, intuitively perhaps, we've had moments of. But this is a training in which we seek more and more to live from that kind of perspective, rather than the perspective of our place, our position, our status, our ego. And that takes courage, in a way. It also takes work. This is a practice, really, that if we take it seriously, is something that we'll be doing for the rest of our lives. It's not something you can do for a certain period of time and get enlightened and then you can go off and do something more interesting. But it is really about a way of living in this world. And the consequence of assuming and discovering within oneself this kind of perspective is that it leads quite organically to the second noble truth, which is that of letting go of grasping. You can't let go of grasping or clinging or attachment as a kind of willful act. I can't say to you, okay, on the count of three, we're all going to stop being selfish. We're all going to stop thinking about me all the time. It doesn't work like that. And again, in keeping with this idea of conditionality, if we are to effect any lasting change in our lives, we need to understand what are the conditions that give rise to this clinging and grasping, and this fear, and this insecurity. And what would be the conditions that would allow us to experience this world without that incessant trying to clutch and grasp and hold and fear? And I think the Buddha's answer to that is by fully knowing dukkha, fully being open to birth, sickness, aging, death, the tragic dimension of life. And in doing so, becoming, as it were, more attuned to the richness of life itself, the mystery of life itself. And as we come to see things and feel things more and more from that point of view, our relationship to them begins to change. We stop grasping and clinging and racing after things and trying to get rid of things, not because the Buddha has told us to do it, but because we slowly start to realize that it doesn't make any sense. It falls away quite naturally. One of the examples that the Buddha uses in some of the suttas, the discourses, he says it's like a child who loses interest in making sand castles. It's not as though the child goes back to the beach one year and has this great epiphany. Sandcastles is a waste of time. One year, he goes back, or she goes back to the beach, and has lost interest in making sandcastles. Lost interest in childish things, as St. Paul said, I think, somewhere. In other words, you kind of grow out of it. But to grow out of it requires a process of maturation, a process in a way of growing up. And that, I think, is what this process of these four truths is about. It's about living in such a way that we grow out of these kinds of rather childish attachments and unrealistic desires and expectations. And so there's a kind of ease enters into our life. It doesn't mean that suddenly we no longer have any desire for anything or any wanting something or any fear of anything. Of course these things will keep on pouring forth and bubbling up. And in fact I think the Buddha is realistic enough to know that these things will always be around. It's also simply, I mean nowadays we'd understand it simply as the legacy of our neurobiology, of evolution. That craving and hatred and fear, these things the Buddhists are so down on, are basically outdated things, are forms of behavior that gave us survival advantages. And they're very deeply embedded in our prehistory, in our organism. They're always going to be there, but we can be with them in a different way. We don't have to buy into their fantasy. We don't have to keep being tripped up by them and seduced into their agenda of getting this and getting rid of that. But rather we can just see them come and go as simply parts of life itself, but we don't have to hold on to them. And the more that we see the world as transient, as tragic, as in some respects not me, impersonal, just processes, the less we will instinctively want to control them from our egotistic perspective. And it's such letting go, such dropping away, this falling off of habits, that leads to moments when we suddenly find ourselves not being driven by these things at all. Moments of complete openness and trust, of a certain transparency, of a certain inner calm and peace, even in the midst of great turmoil or great crisis. And such moments may not last for very long, but they give us a glimpse, they give us a hint that in fact we can live in this world without being conditioned and dictated to by these urges and drives, by these hatreds and fears, by these egotistic compulsions. We can live from the world, we can live in this world unconditioned by such things. And those moments are what the Buddha describes as Nibbana, the blowing out. Nibbana, or Nirvana, does not therefore refer to some kind of transcendental experience, something that great saints or monks who have lived in caves for donkey's years achieve, but is actually a possibility, a way of being in this world, in this moment, that's open to us all the time. And it's from that openness, from that stopping, that calm, that unconditionedness by greed and hatred and so on, that a possibility of a path begins. So paradoxically, perhaps, the experience of Nibbana is not the end of the path, but the beginning. The path begins at that point. And a path, remember, is really nothing but a gap, an absence of impediment or obstruction. If you think of a path running across that field, for example, what it is, in fact, is just a bare strip of field minus the grass or whatever other things might have been growing there. It's an open space. But it's a space that allows a freedom of movement. That is what constitutes really a path. It's an openness, an emptiness that allows us to move without being tripped up by anything or blocked by anything. The Eightfold Path the Buddha speaks of starts and persists as an open, unobstructed space. And that open, unobstructed space begins in those moments, those glimpses, that our life can be utterly open and not constrained or constricted or defined by our egotistic desires, by our compulsive aversions or attractions or fears. So we're speaking metaphorically here, but when that space opens up within us, and in many ways that's again what we are opening ourselves to when we sit or walk, each time we sit, each time we walk, each time we just pay attention, we're opening up a space in which we can see more clearly what it is that's trying to hook itself into our mind. And we notice, as I mentioned this morning, how easily we can get whisked away by a thought or a memory or a fantasy or a plan. But as we become more attuned to this way of being, instead of being tripped up and whisked away, we can begin to see more clearly the first eruptions of a particular desire or a particular fear. And rather than you know, trying to sort of deny it or repress it, which would be just an aversive reaction. But neither do we jump aboard its bandwagon. We simply notice it for what it is. And so one of the central qualities of mindfulness practice is acceptance. It's the ability to say yes to whatever is going on in the moment. We may be subject to the most horrible revenge fantasy against our neighbor, for example. Or, as we may have seen in meditation, it sometimes brings up all kinds of suppressed violence or lust or fear, paranoia. And to be mindful, to be open, to be awake, whatever you call it, has got nothing to do with getting rid of these things at all. It's simply allowing ourselves and learning to be with them in such a way that they no longer have control over us. We see them perhaps that much more clearly. We see them for what they are, that they are the play of the mind, that they are the inheritance of our biological past, that they are part of our conditioning as a child, whatever it might be. It's not about denying, but nor is it about blindly accepting. It's an ability to step back, to open up, and just see more clearly what's going on. And from within that space, opening up another way of responding to this world that is not the result of habit or conditioning, but has achieved, as it were, a degree of freedom. A freedom from grasping, a freedom from hating, a freedom from fear, that allows what the Buddha calls a more authentic vision, authentic thinking, speaking, acting, working. It's not just about our spiritual life at all, but rather it's about our engagement, our ongoing engagement and participation in this world that is pouring forth and vanishing endlessly each moment. So that, I feel, in a very brief summary really, is what constitutes the whole idea of awakening. And if we want an even more explicit definition of this, at the very end of the first sermon, after the Buddha has introduced these four truths and described them, and where he's applied a specific action to each one, he then says, and I quote, "It was not until I had realized these four truths in all their aspects that I could consider myself to be a fully awakened one in this world with its men and its gods, its ascetics and its priests." Now, when he says these four truths in all these aspects, he's referring to how he has recognized dukkha, he has fully known dukkha, how he has let go of craving, experienced stopping, and created a path. So his experience as qua Buddha has nothing to do with his having come to direct knowledge of an absolute truth or reality at all. But it has to do with his processual engagement with these with this complex of truths. He doesn't use the word truth as though it were a singularity, but he uses it again as a plurality of truths, four truths, each of which has to be engaged with in a specific way. He's talking about a living process, a living practice. He's not concerned with achieving some kind of final or absolute state of mystical perfection. later Buddhism, admittedly, has shifted into that kind of direction. I agree. But when we take a careful look at these very earliest texts, which I've been doing today, a different kind of picture begins to emerge. And personally, I find that picture not only to be more true to the early canon, but also to be more applicable and effective in living my own life. And I would hope that what I've shared with you might likewise be of help to you. But that's, of course, up to you. But I will stop here and now open the room for any comments or questions that anyone might have. And we can, we've got about half an hour left to do this. Yes?
Could you say something a bit more about the sequential nature of the process you've described? Because I think I would have always thought before you spoke today that the Eightfold Path would be insistent towards the first four.
Okay.
And therefore, you know, actually, I'm thinking, gosh, I'll never get to this topic, so I'll never start on the Eightfold Path. You know, that sort of feeling that you can't.
Yes.
Engaging with all of it at the same time.
Okay, so the question, did you hear at the back? Probably not. If I can try and summarise. The questioner would like me to say a little bit more about the sequential nature of what I've been speaking. She said that until she heard what I just said, she'd always thought that the Eightfold Path was a kind of, sort of, what do you say? An assistance.
Yeah.
It helped us get into the Four Truths or whatever. Well, this in fact is pretty much the widespread view. And that's what I remember being taught and believing for a long time. But I remember when I was actually a Tibetan monk when I first was puzzled by this, because I kept bumping into admittedly somewhat obscure texts that described the experience of the Eightfold Path as the result of enlightenment. And I thought, that's odd. I thought the Eightfold Path is what the beginners did. Right? But not at all. Now, likewise, you find throughout and consistently within the Pali Canon, when the Buddha talks about this first experience of awakening, which is called stream entry, you've probably heard of that, entering the stream, when he's asked, but what do you mean by the stream? He always replies, well, the stream is the Eightfold Path. Okay? Now, this, I remember really finding a bit puzzling, because it seemed at odds with the idea that the Eightfold Path would maybe one day get you somewhere to call enlightenment. But actually it's the other way round. I'm not making this up, you know. This is true. This is quite clearly the case. And it also, you see, the Eightfold Path has become relegated to a kind of beginner's template. Whereas in fact, if you look at just the sequence of the entire scope of the Buddha's teaching, the very first thing he introduces in the first sermon, he says, monks, I have found a middle path, an Eightfold Path. The very last thing he says to his last disciple, when he's 80 years old and he's lying down on his deathbed, and this last guy comes along and asks to receive a teaching, and the Buddha and I think the question is something like, and how do I know that something is a teaching of you? And the Buddha says, you can recognize that if the Eightfold Path is included within it. So in other words, the Eightfold Path is the defining motif, the leitmotif of the Buddha's teaching. And I would argue that, well, the very structure of the Four Truths, the Eightfold Path is the fourth truth. Now, Buddhist orthodoxy has done all kinds of mental gymnastics to try to somehow present that as not being the case. But if, you know, it's there, you know, suffering, and then the origin of suffering, then the end of suffering, then the Eightfold Path. It's a very back-to-front sort of way to do it. It doesn't sit happily. It's not a very economic way of reading that model. But if we think of it in terms as it is presented, And we look at these other teachings that very explicitly make the path as the goal, then I think we need to perhaps readjust, or I found at least, I had to radically readjust my whole sense of what Buddhism was about.
So does that mean that there's no point in following the Eightfold Path?
Well, okay, now this actually is the second part of your question too. Then you think, oh well, I'll never get onto the Eightfold Path because how am I ever going to experience Nibbana? And you see, this I think is Nibbana has been raised up onto this enormous pedestal. It's been put out of reach, effectively. And only, you know, monks who spend years in caves in Thailand have even got a spitting chance of getting close to it. But curiously, of course, the view of Nirvana as, you know, the holy grail of Buddhism is, of course, the view of monks who sit for years in caves meditating. Mm. It's you see, the people who have carried this tradition have inevitably, perhaps, stamped it with their own particular biases and preferences. Buddhism has become a kind of elite spirituality for renunciant monks. And the whole of the way the path is presented, I feel, has been biased in that direction. Now, therefore, the whole idea of Nibbana as some impossibly difficult thing to attain, we have to question that. You see, there are many instances in the canon where the Buddha gives a talk and then it'll say at the end, and having heard that talk, so many people became stream entrants or arhats. You have the idea, when you read the Pali literature, that to become a stream entrant is not that difficult. What it really entails is somehow having had a moment, a conscious moment in your life, in which your priorities have shifted. And you've consciously somehow affirmed that from now on, however imperfectly, I don't want to live my life just at the behest of my drives and fears. I want to live a life that's more grounded, more rooted, more compassionate, more wise. And there's one passage in the Samyutta Nikaya where the Buddha is asked, you know, what is stream entry or enlightenment, which implies experience of Nibbana. And he says, anyone who has taken refuge in the Buddha and the Dhamma and the Sangha has entered the stream. Mm. In other words, it's actually about a kind of commitment. And my own sense is that stream entry at the time of the Buddha was equivalent to what we would rather flippantly call nowadays a getting on message. you get it and you think, well, yes, that's what I'm going to do. That sounds really true. I can commit myself to that. It's a kind of commitment. It's a kind of engagement. And again, I think, and in Zen Buddhism, I think has served quite well to debunk some of the this rather exaggerated sense of enlightenment by pointing out that enlightenment is a possibility at any moment for anyone at any time. It's not some distant goal. And if you have convinced yourself that it is a distant goal, then that's probably going to be a self-fulfilling prophecy. But if you are open to the fact that just by being fully present in any given moment, you can have experiences in which you surprise yourself, in which it may be only momentary, but you recognize that there's so much more to life than you initially had suspected. I think we've all probably had moments of this nature. I don't think it's that remarkable. But on the other hand, you don't want to trivialize it either. This is always the difficult balancing act. I mean, so somehow we have to find a way of being with these ideas in which we afford them a value and we respect these things, we hold them in some esteem, we don't diminish their power in changing our lives, but at the same time, to recognize that they are accessible that perhaps we've already had such moments in our lives at different times and places, that we don't want to put it all out of reach. And I think all religions suffer from this. I mean, this was the critique of religion by Feuerbach, who influenced Marx, was that religion, when it becomes an institutional power, particularly allied to certain political forces, tends to become a system of alienation. In other words, it gives you the impression, the more powerful it gets, that you are increasingly deluded, corrupted, evil, sinful, or the Buddhists would say, ignorant, greedy, hateful. And only the highest sort of prelates and priests and monks really have got a firm grasp on these higher truths. So I think we have to see Buddhism not just as a spiritual tradition, but also as an institution of power that has operated throughout Asia for thousands of years, or 2,500 years, and I think has succumbed to those kinds of behavior that actually create a gulf between Joe Buddhist on the street and the great enlightened monks and roshis and lamas who live in their nice temples. And periodically Buddhism has broken with this. I mean, Zen broke with it, Shinran, the founder of the Pure Land School in Japan, he broke with it. There's constantly a sort of anti-tradition at work in the heart of these institutions. And I feel at our present point in time, as Buddhism is now trying to make sense of itself in terms of modernity, I think we really have to consider revising our assumptions and our perceptions of the whole thing, coming back to some sort of new beginning. And I feel to do that, we need to go, well, at least my own approach is to go try to get back to the earliest strata of canonical text, and try to build up from the base again. We also, I think, need to be very aware of the social context, the religious context in which Buddhism emerged, and to differentiate what the Buddha was doing from what the Brahmins and the priests of that time were doing as well. It's a complicated business. Next question. Yes.
When you were talking about the Four Noble Truths, and the first one in particular, I think you used two different words for the injunction of how we would act. At one point you said no to dukkha or suffering, and then you also used the word embrace.
Yeah, that's right.
I can understand how you mean no in the way you're using it. I have more difficulty with what you mean by embracing it. Perhaps you could elaborate on that.
Thank you. Well, as with all of these things I'm trying to say, I'm struggling for words. It's an ongoing experiment. The word in Pali is parinya, which translates literally as fully know. When the Tibetans translated it, it became yongsu sheba, which means totally know, comprehensively know. But again, I think it perhaps gives somewhat too much of a cognitive bias. Now, in other words, it becomes a little bit rationalistic to fully know something. To know something, certainly. To fully know, yes, we can know things with our body, we can know things intuitively, we can know things through feeling. I think all of that is implied in the word fully. But I didn't get into this in my talk this afternoon, but we have also, of course, to recognize that dukkha is not just going on in my body, but dukkha is going on in the world. And for this reason, I think to embrace dukkha is to embrace the suffering of the world. I think to fully know the suffering of the world doesn't quite cut the mustard, as the Americans say. I mean, I also feel it's very crucial that when the Buddha talks of the path, the whole business beginning with the fully knowing of dukkha, it's also an injunction to compassion. When we begin to be more attuned to the tragic nature of our own existence, when we begin to maybe wear down a bit the rigidity of our self-centeredness, that has the effect also of making us more empathetically open to the far, far greater dukkha that is going on all around us, in others, in the environment, in all over the place. And we only have to open the newspaper to know that. So I feel that this, if you extend this idea of dukkha parinya, fully knowing dukkha, it leads not just to another relation with your own birth and death, but it is actually opening you up already to the question of the suffering of the world. And so that's why I would use the word embrace, because I think that captures both emotively and empathetically perhaps what that in fact feels like. It means opening your arms to dukkha. And so I feel that fully knowing dukkha is not just about being more intelligent or wise or knowledgeable, but also about being more empathetic, about being more compassionate, about being more accepting of others. And so you can, I think, argue a case that the Buddhist path does not end in wisdom and compassion. They're there already at the beginning. And also, I don't think we must be careful not to think of these four truths and the Eightfold Path as a linear process. It's actually a feedback loop. Because when you get to the end of the Eightfold Path, what do you have? You have mindfulness and concentration. What are you mindful of? What do you concentrate on? And you come back, I think, to dukkha, to the suffering and the tragedy of life and the world. And so at each revolution of this spiral, you deepen, as it were, your engagement with dukkha itself, which again becomes the precondition for another falling away, however slight, however temporary, of certain graspings and holdings. Yes?
How does one embrace suffering without feeling...
without feeling overwhelmed by it? Yeah.
Overwhelmed and depressed.
Well, you see, this, I think... I mean, obviously, each of us has to work this out for ourselves. But I think, again, the beginning of an answer to that question comes with, again, examining ourselves. What is it within ourselves that makes us feel helpless or overwhelmed? I think often it's because we lack any kind of sort of focus or stability within ourselves for all kinds of reasons. And I think the practice of paying attention, of being more focused and concentrated, but also about consciously adopting a kind of moral value system by consciously seeing our life within the framework of, say, a spiritual path. All of that, I think, helps us become more grounded in ourselves, become more open and willing to deal with the difficulties of our own life and those immediately around us. And over time, I feel that that stability, that openness, that trust extends further and further afield. It would be wrong to think that this or any other spiritual or religious tradition has somehow got an answer to these problems. All it is doing, all that this practice I think can do, is help us both as an individual and perhaps as a community of others who share such values to find greater resources within ourselves to deal with the actual issues at hand, rather than be too concerned about how am I going to solve, you know, poverty in Africa, for example. I think if we have to start really where we are now, in our own immediate world, and then from that basis to move out. That's all I can say, really. Yes?
How does the idea of being on the path sit with non-duality? I have a friend who has written a couple of books about non-duality. I was on the path for 20 years, and it's only when I got off the path that I started to understand.
This refers back to the Vedantic tradition, largely, the idea that's particularly Advaita Vedanta, the non-dual Vedanta. To answer the question, one would really have to go more into the background of that whole tradition, which is a bit complicated. But I personally feel that the Buddha was actually reacting against that. The Vedanta, that idea that we are already, as it were, one with God, that there is no duality between Brahman and Atman, between the individual person and the absolute reality, and to rest in that is actually sufficient in itself. That is the goal, here and now. I don't accept that. I think that is premised on a form of theism that does not, to me, make much sense. So I don't think the idea of the Buddhist path and the idea of non-dual Advaita type being, you know, doing nothing is often the idea. There is nothing to do. There's no practice. You just have to be fully. That can be, I think, a useful injunction for someone who gets a bit too stuck, particularly in thinking that the path has got all these steps that I've got to laboriously follow. It can be a good wake-up call from that. But I have difficulty with that notion as an adequate or coherent model for living my life. Yes?
From your description of the Four Noble Truths in the Path, and from my previous understanding as well, also from reading your book, Buddhism of Effortless, I have a feeling or a sense that it's possible to approach this path and this practice from a perspective of being atheist, agnostic, or indeed from following perhaps from even a belief in a Christian God, whatever.
Uh-huh.
In your book, you argue for a sort of in a very convincing way for a sort of a sense of agnosticism.
Uh-huh.
I just wondered if you could talk about the possibilities of perhaps having a Christian faith and following the path, or being atheist and following the path. And just talk about that.
Well, it's true that in that particular book I did argue for a kind of agnostic view, to which I would, you know, I would very much stick to that. I think more recently, though, I would consider myself more and more as an atheist than as an agnostic. I don't see any intrinsic reason why a person could not practice the sort of things we've been describing here as a committed Christian. I don't see any real reason why not. And in fact, I think there are many Christians or people with Christian beliefs or faith who participate in these sorts of retreats and find all of this very helpful. So the actual practice itself, I think, can be taken up irrespective of your particular metaphysics. Nonetheless, I would argue, I think, that for in the end, I think, if you follow the kind of vision that the Buddha outlines in these early texts, I feel there is very little, if any, room for the idea of God. Frankly, I don't think the word God really helps here at all. It may be because of your culture or your tradition, your upbringing, that it seems almost impossible to not think in God-like language or in God speak. But frankly, I feel that certainly the Buddha and all of the Buddhists for all of these years have never had any need to have recourse to the idea of God. In the Western culture, it is so much part of our tradition that it's very difficult for many of us to let go of that language. I was not brought up a Christian. I never have spent any time in a theistic tradition, and I've never felt that I've missed anything. I never find any I've never, I can't think of any occasion where I've been stuck for a word and the only one that would seem perhaps to fit would be God. I don't find the need to use the word God at all, and yet I find that whether it's in traditional Buddhist language or in my interpretations of it, I can speak quite coherently about what matters most to me as a person, as a human being, without referring to God at all. I don't think you need the idea of God in order to articulate a comprehensive and philosophically coherent view of life. I think that, for me, God is past its sell-by date in that sense. Yes?
Following on from that, I so appreciate your clarity. Everything makes so much sense. A part of Buddhism, which I've never been able to understand, and I wonder how you understand or can speak about, is reincarnation.
Oh, God. Well, you see, I think reincarnation and karma in Buddhism are as past their sell-by date as theistic ideas are in other religions. You see, karma and rebirth, to a large extent, in socially, serve the same function in Buddhist societies as God does in Christian societies. In other words, they provide an explanation in a pre-modern, pre-scientific society of things that are otherwise inexplicable. Like, why is my child born with Down syndrome? It's the kid's karma. It's God's will. Equally, both explanations are equally, you know, they are equally lacking in explanatory power. And yet they're consoling. They give us a frame of thinking that makes sense of what is otherwise incoherent. I don't believe in reincarnation. I don't believe in the law of karma whatsoever. I think these are artifacts of ancient Indian civilization and that they are not intrinsic to what the Buddha taught.
So what you're saying, if you go right back to the beginning,
well, that's another story. You see, the beginning, you see, the Pali Canon is a highly complex body of materials in which there are many, many narrative voices, many different strata of ideas, and the Buddha certainly belongs to a world in which karma and rebirth were so normative, were so much taken for granted, that he spoke in that language, or at least he's recorded as having done so. But there are passages, a number of passages, in which he quite clearly takes issue with those points. He doesn't reject them, he just says, if you follow that line of thought, it's not going to help. The Buddha is a pragmatist, primarily. He's not an ontologist, he's not interested in giving us a final description of how reality works. He's interested in fully knowing dukkha and the things I've just explained. And this is what he says consistently. So he's a pragmatist, he wants a therapeutic approach to living life, both individually and communally, that is freed from the burden of metaphysics. And that, I'm afraid, is where we must stop. Thank you. Will you ask me to stop?